The Spectator is partnering with private bank Julius Baer to find the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. This is a new podcast from The Spectator. Well, not so new now. Lockdown is soon entering its fourth month. And during lockdown, we've been asking our writers to read some of the articles they've written in this week's magazine. I'm Fraser Nelson, and joining me for this podcast, we've got Lawrence Fox, the actor who's written about the perils of speaking out, Lucy Kellaway from the FT. Now she left journalism for teaching, and she writes about what it's like to be teaching a class in lockdown, how she fears for the longer-term implications of lockdown, and finally, Toby Young, who tested negative to COVID, much to his dismay, and set about trying to prove the tests wrong. First, Lawrence Fox.
First, they came for the statues. Basil Fawlty got cancelled, and three spoiled millionaires turned on their creator. So it was with J.K. Rowling's woke progeny. Harry Potter, it would seem, is deathly shallow. Rupert Grint looked for a moment like holding firm, but he too quickly succumbed to the growing pressure to slip his golden dagger between Rowling's shoulder blades. Surely these rich list regulars are perfectly placed to say what they actually think, protected from the ever-tightening vice of censorship? Apparently not. Fearing for their virtue, or their future, or both, the three children rounded on their mother. We must hope for better from Neville Longbottom. I too have come to the conclusion that I may never get an acting job again without expressing correct opinions. Well, this probably isn't the end of the world for you. It is a cause of some sadness and anxiety for me, not least because I've always loved my job and also because I have two children who need dinner and clothes and a holiday once in a while. In my job, there is a lot of waiting around and a lot of banter and more serious conversations that take place on set. Until very recently, my views on life were met mostly with good humour and, if not always agreed with, always respectfully tolerated. The genesis of this rather bleak view of my prospects came after my appearance on Question Time, where I voiced, slightly exasperatedly, a heresy that I'm fairly confident is held by a sizable proportion of the population. The heresy was that far from being hounded out by the baying racists of this statistically very tolerant and diverse country, Meghan Markle might, just might, have left for other reasons. Having spent years around actors, a fairly common trait is an enormous ego and the desire to be the centre of attention. I include myself very firmly in this bracket. So with little mental gymnastics involved, I wondered whether her departure might have had something to do with her being denied the limelight that she craved. I'd said this before on Gogglebox, and no one had batted an eyelid, but that was 6 months earlier, which, amid such blossoming clusters of the pathogenic spread of the woke religion, is an eternity. My opinion was further bolstered as I watched the brave and admired prince slowly compost and droop before our eyes into a bit of a sop. Less Prince Hal, more Prince... Hang on, what do I say next, darling? In this progressive monoculture, with its zealous quest for faraway utopias, I had committed a grave sin. I had used my white privilege to berate and bully a person of colour, as the Ethnic Minority Subcommittee of the Actors Union Equity put it. Denounce him. Disgraceful, came the cries from the illiberal liberals who see race in every injustice and cry fascism at anyone who doesn't view the world from their same narrow and unstable ledge of conformity. The media had a field day. Fortunately, I'd had the sense, before my brain became so scrambled I couldn't think, to hire myself a very good lawyer. Something others without my dwindling financial privilege can ill afford, and Equity was reminded politely but firmly that the clue to its job was in the title of its organisation. It agreed to apologise and remunerated me for my troubles. Subsequently, the whole of the Equity Minority Ethnic Members Committee and then the newly formed Racial Equality Committee resigned, and as far as I can tell, the whole union is on fairly wobbly ground. Time passed, I set about removing the tar and the feathers, and the left-wing commentary app patted itself on the back and moved on. Deliberately or not, though, they'd missed the real story. Which was more likely, that Britain is an overwhelmingly tolerant and welcoming country, one that people risk their lives in attempting to reach, or that Britain is a place where racism and bigotry hide in plain sight? One of these stories sells papers, and the other one is true. Anyway, all this is by the by. I use this story to point out that even in the smallest, most apparently meaningless situations, identity politics can cause ripples that turn into bigger and more powerful waves when whipped up by the winds of the outrage media. Our silence at their corruption is read by them as consent. On the 25th of May, the world watched as a policeman kneeled on a man's neck for almost 9 minutes, killing him. Our jaws dropped in horror and disgust. Something needed to be done. Justice needed to be done and seen to be done. On that we were all agreed. Black lives matter. Three such powerful words. Words we could all unite behind. But was it that simple? A week later, I got a text from a very well-known young actor with a screenshot of a tweet of mine which read, "Every single human life is precious, the end." "Can you explain this to me?" said the message. My phone rang, I picked it up, and I knew straight away that my friend and I were not alone on the call. I heard a quiet shushing, an awkward pause, the white noise on the line changed to speakerphone levels, the louder background, the less intimate voice that give these things away. "Hey, Lars, I want to really understand you, you know what I mean? I defend you, as you know, and I really love you. You're an actor, darling, the only thing you love is the mirror. But this is really hard." "Which part of it?" I said. Can't you just see it's wrong?" "What?" I said. "Lars," came the gently menacing reply. "How can I defend you, man, when you're saying shit like this?" "Shit like what?" I said. "That every single human life is precious. Which part of that is problematic for you?" "It's racist," came the reply. Cue deep sigh. Let me say at this point that I firmly believe that most people take on the BLM mission statement at face value and support it in kind. I'm aware that I'm not black and I have no concept of the lived experience of anyone other than myself. Now, where was I? Yeah. I asked my chum what they saw when they looked at the media coverage of this whole story. I asked whether they'd heard of David Dawn, a retired policeman gunned down by a looter attempting to steal a TV once the rioting began in the news. I asked whether they thought that David Dawn's, also black life, had been murdered in cold blood, yet George Floyd's senseless killing dominated every headline. I asked whether they thought it was significant that the man who gunned down David Dawn when caught would be charged with first-degree murder, and yet George Floyd's killer would be tried for second-degree murder at best. I asked, was this fair? I asked whether the media might perhaps be complicit in fanning the flames of outrage. Whether George Floyd's equally precious life was being used to serve other more sinister objectives. There was a silence. We ended the call frostily and we haven't spoken since. My conclusion is that this tragic situation has become part of another narrative. A series of stories wound together to serve a broader societal aim. Righteous global outrage at a cruel and vile killing has morphed into a different agenda. Similar things have happened with other movements. Me Too, Extinction Rebellion, Brexit, even the COVID-19 pandemic. The left rightly expose great chasms of inequality and hypocrisy in society and then proceed to throw themselves like lemmings into that void, unable to obey their own edicts. Desperately important causes have been politicised to the point of meaninglessness. Opportunities for action hijacked swiftly by the cynical actors. No human being could fail to be appalled by what happened to George Floyd. We were united in our outrage, but what could have become a moment for unity has instead torn us apart. All injustice needs our collective and righteous anger, but the pursuit of that justice should bring us together and not divide us. Not social justice, not climate justice, not black justice, just justice. We must start with what unites us, beginning with trying to see the best in people, and though some will exploit our good faith, we should offer it nevertheless. We must be aware of a biased media, including our own state broadcaster, the BBC. It has moved from the Jeremy Bowen-style show-not-tell reportage of old to one that describes protests that led to hospitalizations and mass arrests as largely peaceful. Some news suppliers have decided to relativize and even encourage angry mob tactics. So, here I am, a white posh bloke who loves his job, who's worked hard to be good at it, facing an uncertain future, all for the heinous sin of shaking my fist at the ugly, hypocritical and inconsistent god of progressivism. But unhappily for some, my agent and my bank manager mainly, I will continue to say what I believe to be true. I'm not always right and very often wrong, but unless we can accommodate multiple understandings of a situation soon, it will all end with us abandoning words and reason, the tools given to us to heal and come together, in favour of the simpler but far more terrifying tools of engagement, fists, knives and guns. It's already happening, and we should all be concerned by it. We cannot stand by in silence. Words are the answer.
That was Lawrence Fox, now Lucy Kellaway.
It's Monday morning at 9 a.m. and secondary schools in England have just reopened their gates to students in years 10 and 12. I've been looking forward to this moment for 13 long weeks, since that frightening afternoon in March when my colleagues and I gathered around a computer in the staff room and saw a healthier-looking Boris Johnson declare he was shutting schools. But today, I'm not at the Comprehensive in Hackney where I teach economics, welcoming back my students with a rousing lesson on the financial devastation caused by the crisis. I'm surplus to requirements and I'm still marooned at home. What reopening means is that a mere one quarter of year 10, about 40 students, have turned up to school where they will have a short day and learn mainly maths, English and science. My school, like every other in the land, has followed government orders and done a gold-plated risk assessment to ensure these students will be safe. It's laid out rules covering the movement of every teenager for every second of the truncated day that they'll spend there. With barely 40 of them in at any given time, occupying a space built for 750, the risk of anyone picking up the virus must be smaller than of them falling downstairs and cracking their heads on the tiled floor below. It must be far lower than the risk of acquiring COVID-19 at Tesco or Primark, and in a different league of magnitude to the risk of having picked it up last weekend on nearby London fields, where the crowds of picnickers, revellers and drinkers reminded me of Glastonbury. While the health danger to these few students of returning to school is minuscule, the risk to the others of staying at home in their bedrooms, where they've been incarcerated for 3 months on Google Classroom or similar, is monumental. Today, instead of being able to do the part of my job that I love, being in a real classroom with real children, I'm sitting at home staring at some slides I've just made and talking to my computer. "Stop the video now," I'm saying, "and write down the definition of fiscal policy." I'm trying to make my voice sound light and cheery, but my heart is heavy. There are 25 students in this particular class. 8 of them will listen carefully and follow my instructions to a T. A further 8 will do the work more sloppily. The rest will not do it at all. There has been much talk about how the closure of schools has widened the gap in educational achievement. The 8 students who will watch my video and pause every time I say pause are the same 8 I had no worries about before the virus struck. Some are middle-class children and most are girls, but all have a rock-solid work ethic and are well supported by their parents. The students doing nothing are the same students I was fretting about from the moment I started teaching them. Many are poor. Some have behavioural difficulties. Some have complicated special needs. For most, it's a Herculean job to get them to work at the best of times, even with the strict structure provided by the school. None of them has done a single sausage since this nightmare began. For every week of lockdown, all teachers at my school fill in a spreadsheet to track the students who are not working. A drop-down menu gives the option behind with work, but this doesn't quite cover it. It's not just that they're behind with new content, but by September they will have forgotten all the old. And more importantly, they will have lost work habits that the school has been painstakingly instilling since their first day in year 7. According to the Sutton Trust, the damage done to educational inequality from closing schools has undone the work, not of a term, but of a decade. Not only is the gap widening between students in my class, it's widening between north and south, rich and poor, and between state and private schools. Research by UCL's Institute of Education shows that in the southeast, 28% of kids are working more than 4 hours a day, compared to less than 10% in the northeast. The children on free school meals are half as likely to be working hard as richer ones, and over 30% of private schools are offering 4 or more hours of lessons a day, 5 times as many as state schools. Laptops, people have been crying. The poorest kids don't have laptops or internet connections. This is true, and the government and some schools have been trying to redress this, but it's not a perfect solution. Even my students with laptops are losing the will to live the longer this goes on, and I can't blame them. In teenage bedrooms all over the country right now, parents may fancy their kids are doing their economics work on income inequality, but they're not. They're on Fortnite. The damage done to students' mental health is less well chronicled, but no less serious. I phone a teenage boy to find out why he's done no work. It's 3 p.m. and he's still in bed. His once upon a time cheery voice is flat and he talks slowly in monosyllables. Adolescence is rubbish at the best of times, but try doing it in a tiny impoverished flat with no outdoor space, nowhere to go, no one to see and nothing to do, with the guilt of those god-awful slides on Google Classroom hanging over you. All of my teacher acquaintances report conversations like this one, and worse. In longing for schools to go back, I'm at odds with some teaching unions and teachers. I don't blame them for their reticence. Fear of infection is something we all experience differently, and I'm at one extreme of the spectrum. All along, I've wanted schools to open earlier and for more students, not because I'm an evil lockdown sceptic who puts the economy above lives, but because I'm daily aware of the damage done to some students, to their education, mental health, and chances of a decent life. Throughout, Downing Street has done a rotten job in balancing these risks. Its communication has been so patently diabolical, there's no point in going over it again here. What has attracted less notice is its message about the purpose of schooling. In giving priority to the students who are soonest to sit GCSEs and A-levels, it is implicitly saying exams are the point of education. This is both depressing and wrong. Exams are not the point of education. They are evidence that you've acquired some. The students who return this week will be learning how to answer a 9-mark exam question rather than being taught anything of interest. The coronavirus should have been an opportunity for people in education to think about what matters. We've missed that chance. While the government has had a rotten crisis, teachers have had a good one, whatever the Daily Mail might claim. Overnight, with no warning and no training, the entire profession has shifted from whiteboard to wireless. In my old life as a journalist at the Financial Times, it took me 5 years to get used to the move from print to digital. And despite a good deal of training, I still bitched and moaned. When I became a teacher 3 years ago, I was a dinosaur and technophobe. But even I have just about mastered Google Classroom, Zoom, Loom, and the particularly dastardly Google Forms, with little training and not much complaining. We've all proved that it's possible to offer some sort of education online. Some schools are doing this brilliantly, but even the ones who have dragooned pupils into sitting through 5 hours of Zoom a day can't touch the real thing. There is an irreplaceable magic of a live lesson with its ability to motivate, cheer and inspire. A friend who is a documentary maker turned teacher is hatching a plan to carry out 100 desks into a park, place them 2 metres apart and teach Macbeth through a megaphone. I hope she pulls it off. The NEU, the biggest teachers' union, last week put out a plan for closing the gap with lots of good ideas in it, including opening libraries and theatres and other spaces for students to learn in. But there was a phrase in the document that filled me with dread. Blended learning. By next September, we may be teaching small classes in school and doing online teaching simultaneously. I hope it doesn't come to this. I really do. There is only one shred of comfort in this crisis. 4 years ago, when I set up Now Teach, a charity to persuade older people to retrain as teachers, I didn't think it would take a pandemic to do my PR work for me. Possibly it's the experience of homeschooling children, or possibly it's the way most other careers now seem precarious or pointless. Either way, professionals are queuing round the block to become teachers. At each of our recent packed information evenings, held on Zoom, I've told teaching hopefuls what lockdown has taught me. It's not that education matters more than anything on earth. I knew that already. But that old-fashioned schooling is the best way of delivering it. In the last few months, we've seen what happens to students, especially vulnerable ones, when you take away routine, social interaction, detentions, and school dinners. I'm not poor or disadvantaged. I don't have special needs. I do have a functioning laptop and internet connection, and I'm not 15. But I want my school life back, too.
That was Lucy Kellaway, and she discusses this with the economist Paul Johnson in this week's The Edition podcast, also found on Spectator Radio. Next, we've got Toby Young.
The antibody test that proved my wife wrong. Back in April, The Spectator ran a feature in which the partners of regular contributors wrote about what it was like being stuck in quarantine with the likes of us. What Caroline had to say wasn't very flattering. Quote, Toby spent the first week of lockdown in bed, convinced he had coronavirus. He didn't. He's a complete hypochondriac at the best of times, and this pandemic has sent his anxiety levels through the roof. He was so worried about catching it that the stress led to a bout of shingles, which is what actually laid him up. Unquote. Ever since then, I've been trying to prove to her that I really did have COVID-19, but without success. For instance, a well-wisher got in touch to tell me he was developing an antibody test and would send me one if I was happy to serve as a guinea pig in his clinical trial. If I'd had it, as I claimed, this would be a good way of seeing if his test worked. But what if I didn't have it? I asked. But you did have it, didn't you? He said, slightly surprised. Yes, yes, of course. I asked him to send me 6 so I could test Caroline and the children as well, and they duly arrived by courier the following day. Technically, it was a lateral flow immunoassay, which means you had to prick your finger, place a drop of blood in the well of a little plastic tray, add a few drops of the assay solution, and then wait for the result. Within a few minutes, it would tell you whether you had any immunoglobulin M in your blood, in which case you were probably fighting off a recent infection, or immunoglobulin G, which suggests you'd had it some time ago. Alternatively, nothing would happen, indicating you'd never had it. I took one of the plastic trays out of its sealed packet, you can only use them once, and did what was required. It works like a pregnancy test, so once you've submitted the sample, you then have to wait for the little line to appear in the relevant place, or not, as the case may be. Caroline was peering over my shoulder as I stared at the little tray, and the children sat round the kitchen table, eagerly looking up at me. It doesn't seem to be working, I said, giving it a vigorous shake. Caroline giggled, and the children rolled their eyes. Maybe I didn't use enough blood. I'm going to try again. Hang on, said Caroline. If you use another one, then we won't be able to test ourselves. Can't be helped, I said, tearing the next one open. I'm the guinea pig, after all. To hoots of laughter and derision, I pricked my finger again, this time much harder, and dripped blood into the well of the tray. Again, nothing. I then tried another, then another. Same result every time. Eventually, when I'd used up 5 tests, I offered the last one to Caroline. What's the point? She asked, eyes shining with amusement. It obviously doesn't work. Ever since then, I've had to endure hours of what my children call bants. If I complain of being tired or of having backache, one of them will say, What's the matter, Dad? Another bout of coronavirus? Then another will join in. Want me to call an ambulance? Get you on a ventilator? Even Caroline chips in. Perhaps you should take to your bed for a week, like the last time you had COVID-19. I still clung on to the hope that the tests I'd been sent were defective. So when I saw that a private testing facility had opened in the headquarters of the Honourable Artillery Company in the city, and you could get a bona fide MHRA-approved antibody test for £48, I decided to give it one last shot. I got on the tube on Monday, making sure to wear my mask, and made my way to the testing centre in Moorgate. It was very professional, staffed entirely by ex-army medics, and they assured me that their test, which was similar to the one I'd taken at home, was 98% accurate. I got the result within 10 minutes. On my way back to the tube, I called Caroline. "Looks like you're going to be eating humble pie this evening," I said. She couldn't believe it. But sure enough, I tested positive for immunoglobulin G. Turns out it wasn't man flu after all. "I'm a vegetarian," she objected. "Don't worry," I said. "There's no meat in humble pie. It's full of things that are really good for you."
That was Toby Young, and that's it for this week. If you've got any thoughts about this podcast, what you'd like to hear more of or less of, or anything about our podcasts in general, please do email. We'd love to hear from you, and we read every single email that we get. It's podcasts@spectator.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu.
The Spectator is partnering with private bank Julius Baer to find the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.